when we talk about inner cities, we're talking about a problem that is nationwide, not a problem that is restricted to Philadelphia. And I just got came back from Atlanta, attending a Enterprise Zone conference. The Reagan administration has come up with a new concept. It's the Kemp Garcia concept of enterprise zones, where they want to, it's a way to rehab or generate employment in the inner cities. And I had an interesting time at the zone because there were some questions that no one was able to answer, and I insisted, and they got pretty fired up down there in Atlanta. But I had to cool out because I was in Atlanta. And I had to get back up here to Pennsylvania. So I never did get the answer to my questions. But the inner cities and some of the struggles that we had in Philadelphia emanated because of or was born because of the land and the importance of the land in the inner city. And I say that because at the end of World War II, when poor people, mainly blacks, were leaving the South and coming north to find jobs in industry, at that time the jobs were up here, and now they're down there, referred to as the Sun Belt. But the establishment at that time corralled people. They built projects, and they put black people in the inner cities. And at that time, you must understand that it was very popular to live in the suburbs, where you could go out on the lawn and enjoy the cool with the warm summer breeze. But that was all prior to the energy crisis. Energy conservationists show that in the next 12 to 15 years, there will not be enough energy to travel from the suburbs to the city. So that makes the inner city land extremely valuable. So several years ago, the federal government gave an urbanologist named Anthony Downs $500,000 to do a study on how to recover the inner cities. And Anthony Downs took the money and he did the study. And I wish they had given it to me, because I could have done this study. I would have charged a little less, because all he really said was, you want the land, take it. That was the bottom line, just take it. But he didn't do it exactly like that. But he came up with a term called triage, old French military tactic. When the doctor would go out on the battlefield, he'd look at the wounded, and all those that were too far gone to help, he let them die. All those that could make it without any medical attention, didn't bother with those. Those that he could bring back with a little medical attention, that's where the emphasis was put. And they took this strategy and tried to apply it to inner city neighborhoods. All the neighborhoods that were too far gone, just let them die. Withdraw the services, withdraw your housing money, withdraw the any services that are rendered by the city administration, you withdraw those services, and the community will eventually die. And all those that are financial, you don't put any of your money there. You take those communities that are just on the beginning of decline, and that's where you concentrate your efforts. Well, there was one fallacy that I saw in that whole theory. And although I've never been able to find Anthony Downs or talk to him, when I looked at it, I said, well, if we were on the battlefield, that might be pretty cool, because all those people that you're not going to help, they're going to die, and we can bury them and get rid of them. But all those people that live in those houses and in those communities you're going to let die, while the buildings may deteriorate, the people are not going to die. So the question recurs, what are we going to do with the people? And in north central Philadelphia, where I'm from, there were 120,000 people, according to the 1970 census tracts. And in maybe a 4 or 5 square mile area. I mean, people on top of people. And that's the way the little road, the tight row houses in the inner city, and that's what you find. So when we began to ask questions, and incidentally, I might say this right now, we have never put ourselves in a position where anyone could stand up and say, well, if you had come, we would have done. Now, what do I mean by that? I simply mean that before you saw us acting crazy on television, we had exhausted all of our administrative remedies. See, the system will tell you now, we must create an atmosphere that is conducive to meaningful dialogue and sit down and talk over coffee and work out our problems. So we did that. But we didn't work out our problems. All we did was talk. So the same problem that we had when we went in the room to start talking, we had when we came out. Because there was no resolution to the problem. And so we said, well, why is it that we can develop a plan in the community to say that this is what we want to do and we can't get anything done? And we found out that the plan that the community had was contrary to the plan that the administration had. So that put us on a collision course. And while the administration was implementing the policy of triage or gentrification or recycling, whatever you want to call it, where they withdraw the services and remove people from those areas, we were here talking about programs that were going to stabilize the area and keep us there. So we started the war, as it were. Everybody know we had Rizzo. He was a problem. All right? So we had to deal with Frank. And Frank was the type of guy who would say, I don't like you, so I am not talking to you. And it's pretty hard to deal with somebody who won't talk to you. And when you approach him, he said, get away from me, you bum, you crumb, you slum, call you everything. And he'd keep walking. He would not let you in his office. So that was a problem. So we went to the federal government and we made up big maps. And we said, the Rizzo administration is doing us in. The federal government said, well, what do you mean? We said, well, they're tricking us. They said, well, how are they tricking us? They said, well, the federal government says that if you're going to qualify for community block grant money, you have to have a racial balance in the application. So what Frank did, he had his man hook it up so that the neighborhoods that were contiguous, while you had all the whites on this side and all the blacks on this side, they were contiguous, he would use those neighborhoods to give the impression that there was a racial balance. But when the money came, he put all the money in the white neighborhood. And we said, no, wait a minute, got a problem now. You're using us to get the money, but you're not giving us any of the money. So we made those accusations to the federal government. And the federal government, listen, this is the administrative process, all right? In the rooms that's conducive to meaningful dialogue, sip coffee, smoke cigarettes, not those little skinny ones now, the regular kind. So we're going through the process. And the federal government said, well, this is what you have to do. And I said, tell me about it. So you have to have a Title VI, Section 109, Civil Rights Review. You remember when blacks were fighting for their civil rights? Yes, sir. Well, we have some laws. And these laws apply. I said, fine, let's get the review on. Took us a year and a half to do the review. And when the review came back, it supported our position. And we had a letter from, at that time, Patricia Harris, who was the secretary of HUD in Washington, the president's cabinet. And we had gone to meet with her several times. And she had given me a letter saying that if the accusations that we asserted were in fact true, she would take definitive steps to cut off the money and bring the Rizzo administration in line. And I said, well, that sounds good. That's reasonable. You can't get mad when somebody's reasonable. She said, fine. Went through the process, got study. Study supported our position, running around the community saying, we won, we won, we won, yeah, we won. Got buses and went to Washington, D.C., set up a meeting with Patricia Harris. Went into another room that was conducive to meaningful dialogue. And we sat down at a long table. And I was smiling, you know, and I gave her, I said, here it is, here's the study. Your people did the study. Study supports our position. When are you going to cut off the money? She said, now wait a minute. I said, what? I knew something funny was coming at this point, you see. Now here we have 3 years invested in the administrative process. 76, said last part of 75, 76, and 77. Going into 78. Still hadn't received any money because the administrative process is a long process. Sometimes I think it's deliberate. So, but anyhow, we got into the room. We're sitting down. We're talking to Patricia Harris, and we began to deal with this issue. And finally, I said, well, when are you, you know, here's everything that we had talked about. When are you going to cut the money off? And she looked at me, and I will never forget it. I will never forget it. She looked me in my face, and she said, Street, I know what I told you, but it is not politically feasible for me to cut the money off at this time. I said, what? You mean after 3 years? You're going to tell me that we won, the law's on our side, and you're going to tell me it's not politically feasible? I don't understand. Explain that. And she went on and started talking, but whatever she had to say at that point didn't mean anything to me because I had lost all confidence in civil rights laws, any kind of administrative process and everything else. I said, my God, when you're a little fella and you're out here hustling, if politics, the tentacles of politics penetrate so deeply into the federal government where they can make decisions that are contrary to the law based on politics, then I have to get mad. It's time to get mad. It's time to get angry at this point. So we came, we weren't as happy on those buses going back as we were going down. You know. But we had a decision to make. And that decision was very simple. You've exhausted the administrative process. Now what do you do? Do you throw up your hands and say, well, we tried? That was a consideration. It's always an option. To go as far as you can and then say, well, that's it. So we thought about it and we said, well, we can't stop because our complaints are righteous. I mean, they're true, they're real. So what we did was we decided, well, City of Philadelphia, you have a problem because we're coming at you. So we decided, since City Council had something to do about this mess, we were going to City Council. So we called the president up. Called him personally. His name was George Schwartz. I said, George, you're Melt. Yeah, Melt, what you want? He said, man, you can't have counsel anymore until we get this mess straightened out. Now, that meant that we were going to counsel and disrupt. And I told him. See, you always tell people what you're going to do up front. You don't wait until, you know, you get there and then start it. So I told him, I said, look, we're coming to counsel. And not only are we coming, we are not going to let you administrate until you deal with this problem. He said, I will have you locked up. I said, fine. Went to City Council, and you know the story from there because you probably saw it on television, some of you. Every week for 5 straight weeks, the city could not administrate. But as a result of that, while there was not one dime in North Central Philadelphia, I can say to you now, there's over $24 million allocated to that neighborhood, and it's being spent, and we have rehabilitated some houses in the neighborhood, and we are now moving forward. Now, I don't want you to think that every time you have a problem with government, that you're supposed to disrupt government. I just want you to think that that's what you have to do most of the time. All right? But not all the time. Because government, for the most part, is non-responsive to the needs of people. See, you're young people and you have to understand that laws are not passed because it's righteous. They're not passed because it's human. They're not passed because it's moral. And I am in the process, a part of it. They are passed because it's politically expedient to pass them. The first consideration when it comes to voting is, how's this going to affect me back in my district? So you need to understand that. How's it going to affect me? What do my people think? Okay? Now, most of the time, people don't think anything because they don't know anything about it. It's not too many issues that become so controversial that everybody knows about them. You talk about some issues. There are very few partisan issues that we come in contact with where we just take hard line stands. Democrats versus the Repubs. Okay, D's and R's. All right? Most of the time they cross party lines. But you have a problem, and one of the things that we need to do, Bruce, if we're going to talk about changing this system, we have to change the government. We have to change the political structure. In Pennsylvania, we have too many people in the House of Representatives. You don't need 203 people in the House of Representatives to govern. It's too cumbersome. And it bogs down the process. And it makes it very difficult to get anything done. And they cannot control. I used to have a fantasy when I was a little boy. You know, everybody has fantasies, right? And I wanted me a job where I could get up at 12 o'clock and I could go to work at 12:30, have a half hour off for lunch and go home at 1 o'clock. You know. I figured, this is bad. And get a good salary, right? Well, as I grew older, I said, well, you know, I have to cut that fantasy loose. Because there is no job like that in the world. Until I was elected to the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. I was elected to the Pennsylvania State House, went up there and didn't like it. Didn't like what I found, didn't like what I saw, didn't like the office they gave me. And I went out on the floor of the House of Representatives the third day, and I said, I am not coming back. Bye. Y'all won't see me until you straighten this mess out. And I went back to Philadelphia. I said, well, that's it. About 3 days later, the chief clerk called me. Said, where you want me to send your check? I said, what? Where you want me to send your check? I said, well, I'm not coming to Harrisburg. You don't send me my check if I'm not coming, do you? He said, well, you are elected representative, and you get paid. I said, you mean I get paid if I don't even come? He said, yes. I said, I found me a job that exceeds my wildest expectations. Never before did I think I could find this. I don't even have to go for a half hour and take lunch. I mean, it's real. Now, that happened. It was in the paper. And I stayed away for 6 months. And every month, they sent my digit. But I was working back in the district. So my conscience didn't bother me for taking it. I didn't give it back, so you only have to ask that question. I cash the check and spend it. All right? So when that check, when question answer time comes, don't even bother with that one. It's answered already. But anyhow, government is a problem. And we have to deal with that. What we need to do is reduce the size of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Reduce the size of the Senate so that we can have a small body of people that can govern. And that would be a step in the right direction because we could get some quality people in office who would have the ability, I believe, to deal with the issues. However, we must deal with what is. It will not be reduced. We will not shrink the size of the Pennsylvania House because the people who are elected have to do it. And those who are elected are not going to do it because they say, I might be voting to off my seat. Not going to do that. So therefore, we have to deal with what we have to work with. And that's not very much. I'm serious. You know, we have some functional illiterates in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. And I don't say that to be funny. I say that because it's real. We have some people who come and they don't ever know what's going on. They watch the board, and if everybody on their side of the aisle is voting yes, they'll vote yes. If everybody's voting no, they'll vote no. They cannot make a meaningful contribution to the process. But those of us who are black, all my black brothers and sisters out there, I talk to you for a minute, because we have a bigger problem than do our white brothers and sisters, although they have some problems too. We're all in the same sinking ship. Well, some of us are on the bottom of the ship, we drown first. Others up here, all right? But we're in the same ship. But we have some serious problem because most of us live in areas that are defined as communities, but they are really not communities. Because when you think about a community, you think about a neighborhood where the people control its politics, its economics, its institutions. And when they control that, they have community unity. And when they have community unity, they have community discipline. And when they have community discipline, their problems begin to dissipate because the people who live there can take care of the problems. But we don't have that. We don't control our politics. We don't control our economics. We don't control our institutions. So therefore, we are a group of people who live in a geographical location, and that's about it. And I have to be serious. However, we have a bigger problem because there is a large percentage of us who do not participate in the electoral process. We do not vote. Therefore, we are not considered when I get up into the halls in Harrisburg. And when I call Senator Hines down in Washington, I understand that it's going to be very difficult to bring you the goods and services that you need because you are not considered a viable constituency in the eyes of the people who make the decision. And that's the political end of it. You are considered throwaway people. When you throw away something, you're talking about trash. And I get upset when I talk about this because somehow I cannot get it through the minds of my black brothers and sisters that you have to get involved in the political process. And until you get involved in the political process, you will not be viewed as a viable constituency. And politicians do not address themselves to constituencies that are they don't consider as being viable. And you are considered the throwaway people. You are considered parasites, leeches. You drain from, but you put nothing back. We live in areas that have a high unemployment. We live in areas through no fault of your own. We live in areas where a large percentage of us are on welfare, and we live in areas where a large percentage of us do not exercise our electoral rights. We do not register. We do not vote. And therefore, we are considered parasites. We are considered leeches. I'm saying it again. They are considered a constituency that drains from, that takes out of the system, but puts nothing back. So consequently, we live on the valuable land in the inner cities, and the plan is to get you off. You say to get us off. Why? Because the government is considered a business, and you need money to operate a business. And if you do not work, and if you do not pay taxes, then you are not making any contribution to operating that business. But yet you use the services. You want the trash truck, you want the police department, you want the water trucks, you want the electric department, you want all of the services that the city or the borough has to offer, but you're not making any contribution to the administration or the operation of that business. So therefore, you're in a hell of a position. You need to go back to your communities and deal with that. And it makes it even more difficult. Because if we want to come together for common cause, and I want my Italian brothers, and my Jewish brothers, and my Irish brothers, and the black brothers, and we come together and we say, look, old Frank Rizzo has to go. We gotta get his butt out of City Hall. And we're gonna unite together to get him out. And the dialogue goes like this. Well, Jewish community, how many votes can you produce on election day? Well, we have a small population. We're only about 8% of the registered Democrats and Republicans in the borough. But we can guarantee that 90% of that 7% will go to the polls and vote. That's good. Irish community, how many people can you get out? Well, we can get out about 85% of our people. What about you, Italians? Well, yeah, we can get our people out to the polls. Well, what about you? Well, now if it doesn't rain. Doesn't rain on election day. First thing I got to do is check and see how many of them registered. And that's the reality. See, I have to be honest about the situation that we're in. Because what I get sick and tired of, and I'm still talking to my black brothers and sisters, what I get sick and tired of is us blaming racism for all our problems when racism has nothing to do with most of our problems. It's economics. It's economics. Nothing to do with race. Throw you out the city because you black. Throw you out there because you're not making any contribution. That's what we have to deal with. And until you look at that, and until you deal with that, you're going to have a problem. You're going to have a problem. All right? Now, we have to form coalitions. Whites, blacks, Puerto Ricans, we must form coalitions. That is where our strength lies. We have to form them with these women groups around. Can't leave the women out, they get mad at you. Right? But we have to come together for common cause. If we're ever going to talk about changing government, you know, we talking about reform. We need to change government. But we can't change government until everybody gets his or her act in order. And that's a big problem. So I wonder if government's ever going to change. What I think's going to happen is that everything gonna be like it is. We gonna come, we gonna go, our children gonna come, they gonna go, and it's gonna be like a big revolving door. Big revolving door. Because young people today, you are not involved in the process like the young people of the 60s were. The young people on college campuses, you are not involved like the young people of the 60s were. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Some of you read your history. But so much for that. Let me just talk about this economic development for a minute. We need jobs. And where we're going to find jobs is in small businesses. Find jobs in small businesses. We can, I believe, stabilize the state of Pennsylvania and generate employment. But I believe the employment in the 80s, for the most part, is going to be found in the area of energy. That's where I believe employment's going to be found. I believe it's going to be found in solar heat. I believe it's going to be found in insulation of homes, weatherization, manufacturing of insulation, storm windows, bringing the coal out of the Pennsylvania coal mines. Hopefully we could recycle those economic dollars in the state of Pennsylvania by getting the ports in order down in Philadelphia to receive the coal. But right now, we're not ready. Right now, we're taking more coals out of the mines than we can ship, than we can transport. The railroad is falling apart. So consequently, we are not prepared, and I don't understand why energy conservation has been predicting an energy shortage for the last 20 years. Pennsylvania lawmakers didn't have enough perception, obviously, to make preparation for the crisis when it got here. We have a lot of natural resources in the state of Pennsylvania, and we can generate jobs. We could generate jobs transporting coal across those railway, if the railway was suitable, down to the port of Philadelphia. Right now, we take it out and we send it up to New York or down to Newport News someplace. What they can handle. So we can generate jobs in the state of Pennsylvania. We can create jobs in the inner cities. But we have to create those jobs because when we look at the number of people that are unemployed, what we do is we categorize them. How many white collar? How many blue collar? How many laborers? How many farm workers? Call us entry level people, unskilled workers. And the Bureau of Employment Security, who is supposed to find jobs for people, all the studies that we've ever been able to get our hands on dictate that the most difficult thing, or the most difficult group of people to find jobs for, are the unskilled, the entry levels. All right? Governor Thornburg has a bill, had one last year, has one this year. Take 63,000 people, 83,000, off of general assistance. Question is, where are the jobs? Okay, and we'll talk about that. Some of you may have some questions about that. But the plan that I believe, based on all of the information that I have been able to gather, for jobs in the state of Pennsylvania is going to be in small businesses. Businesses that will employ, I would say, from 40 people on down to 5 and 6. That's where we're going to generate the jobs. And we have studies that show in the 80s that the jobs are going to have to come from small businesses. But there's a problem. And one of the major problems, again, for the inner city is that if a man or a woman decides to open up a job in the inner city, there's what they call the minimum wage. Now, I hope you will listen to me very closely now. The minimum wage is $3.25 an hour. But you must understand that we have a number of people who are not worth $3.25 an hour. They cannot earn or function at a capacity where they would be worth, where it would be worth it to the employer to hire them. So what do we do when the minimum wage and we're trying to establish a small business is $3.25 an hour, but most of the people in the community aren't worth but $2 an hour? Seems like a problem. So what do? Do we establish a training program? Do we have a sub-minimum wage? How do we address that problem? I don't know. Because you have some people who say that if we have a sub-minimum wage, that's slave labor. And that has been the hue and cry from those people who say, oh, we're going back to slave labor. So you might have a group of potential businessmen and women who will do nothing until that question is answered. And that is one of the questions that we couldn't get answered at the Enterprise Zone Conference. Do we have a minimum wage? Do we not? Or do we not? Or do we have a sub-minimum wage? Now, it may be difficult for you to comprehend or internalize at your ages that you have people in this country who have graduated high school but do not know how to fill out a job application. You have people who have graduated from high school but cannot count. You have people who have graduated from high school, walked away with diplomas, but cannot read. And those people are walking around in the community without jobs, and those are the people who will be going to these small business employers saying, I want to work. You have people in this society who have no frame of reference for work. Say, I open my store at 7 o'clock in the morning. You come in at 7:30 and get mad if you say you're late. So I'm only here for hour 8. What's wrong with that? You couldn't do your business between 7 and 7:30. Don't understand what the business world is about. Nobody goes into business. I have yet to meet the man or the woman who went into business to lose money. You're in the business to earn money. So when we talk about economic development, we're talking about more than just a situation where we build some shops, we develop some manufacturing companies, we do what we have to do, and then we just hire people. We have to prepare people. Automation is doing a job on us. I introduced a piece of legislation last year to try to make a point, knew it wasn't going anywhere, but we could create $42,000, 42,000 jobs, just like that. Tomorrow we could do it if we wanted to, by just outlawing self-service gas stations and outlawing self-service elevators. Used to be a time when people used to work on the elevator. And they were more than just an elevator operator. They became, over a period of time, a source of information. They were almost like you had an information booth in every elevator in City Hall down in Center City. If you want to know what courtroom to go in, you go in the elevator, you say, what courtroom do I go in? Where's courtroom? Then they say, go right down here, around the corner, around the room, boom. And those jobs are gone. All those jobs are gone. Now, those jobs may not have much to offer in terms of upward mobility, in terms of moving forward, but it's better for a man to work for 20 years operating an elevator than it is for him to stand on the corner doing nothing. In my mind, I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy and everybody else is not. But it seems like to me you can't put people out of work and then complain because they're standing on the corners. Used to be a time when the small service station in the area would employ 5 to 10 people, 2 or 3 mechanics, a couple people pumping gas. You go down and take your car down. When I was 17 years old, I had a job in the gas station. All right? Now I'm a member of the state senate, and I still have a job in the gas station. Every time I go get gas, I get out and pump it. You know, I guess you call that upward mobility, you know. But I'm simply saying that it seems like on one hand we say we must deal with the world of computers, and on the other hand we say we must develop jobs for people who aren't prepared to take those jobs. And it's a big problem. I don't have the answer. Perhaps there are some of you here who have the answer. And I think at this time, I will answer some of your questions if you have any. Now, don't everybody jump up at one time. Let me say this to you. I was elected, right? This was fascinating to me. Fascinating, really? I ran as a Democrat. I won 9.5-1. All right? I understood that there were 25 Republicans and 25 Democrats after the results came in. And when I looked at them, you know, I said, wow, this is great. Nobody really controls. Since I am the way I am, maybe I can cut a deal. Yeah. Okay? So listen. Now listen. Reagan won. The Republicans took over the United States Senate. We had 2 Republican senators in the state of Pennsylvania. We had a Republican-controlled House of Representatives. We had a Republican governor. It was to all the Republicans' advantage to have a 26th vote in the Senate so that they could control both the Senate and the House, because you can't pass legislation with 25. So that was very intriguing. I said, maybe something's happening. All right? So I looked at the Democratic side and I said, well, they don't control anything. This is impotency personified. There's no future in staying over here. I have to get over here where the power is. So I went and talked to the Republicans, and they were just as interested in having that 26th vote in the Senate as I was in being in a position to deliver some goods and services to the people that I was elected to represent. All right? Now, I had another decision that I had to make, and that decision was simple, very simple. What can you accomplish as a Democrat? Nothing. All right? Now, You have 100, no, you have 400,000 registered black Democrats in the city of Philadelphia. 400,000. All Democrats. Still voting for Roosevelt. He did. All right? Straight Democrat. Boom, 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 boom. Right? So what I have to do is develop a strategy to get those people to understand that there is no wisdom in having all of your eggs in one basket. You must make people compete for your votes in politics. And the way the behavior of the black community was in Philadelphia, the Democrats could count our votes for a turn of the century. Well, we don't have to worry about the turn of the century. We have those Negroes over there, you know, they're going to vote for us in about 300,000 votes we have over here, if we can get them out to vote. So what I had to get them to understand is the wisdom in balancing the ship. So I had to measure whether I wanted to take on that responsibility. That is an awesome responsibility. Okay, and I decided I wanted to do it. It would be exciting. Okay? I introduced three pieces of legislation, and I've gotten a piece of legislation out of committee on the floor of the Senate already. And the only question was, were the Republicans or are the Republicans really interested in being a party for all the people? Are they really interested in the black vote? Are they really interested in the poor community? That was the only question. And I was convinced by Senator Henry Hager that they were. That they really are interested in all the people. Okay? So what that translates into is all of the things that I did in terms of confrontation politics, I did before I stood up on the stage at the Fairmount Hotel with the governor, with the president pro tem, and with the national president of the Republican Party, hand in hand, talking about we're going to work together. So they were not frightened. It did not any way inhibit my ability to have these important people in government to come forward and say, yeah, we don't mind having the street over here to work with. And I already told them, now y'all mess with me, I go crazy and I might go back over here, you know. So what you do is, I am one of the few who really don't care whether I get elected or not, so I can play fast and loose with the political game. And when you get somebody in politics who don't care about, see, let me put it this way. Once, I'm moving away from your mic. Once you get into a situation, okay, where your own political survival as an elected official is the first consideration, then you don't have the guts to do some of the things that you have to do. But whether I get elected or not is not important. I don't care, because I am marketable. I can earn a living. I don't need politics to earn a living. Okay? So I can do what I can do and say, well, if they don't elect me, so what? So I can just go crazy. I do anything I want to do, I do it. And the constituents come to me and they say, why you do that? And I can defend it. And they'll say, well, you know, it makes sense. But I don't measure and I don't take into consideration what the people in the district's gonna think if I make a decision. I make a decision based on the information I have and I do it, you know. Now, I'm going to introduce a piece of legislation next week, and I guess I shouldn't say this in front of the radio here, but I'm going to say it anyhow. She'll just have it first. But I'm going to introduce a piece of legislation next week that's going to knock them dead. Everybody going to be staggering around. They're going to say, oh, my God, nigga going crazy again. All right? And what's going to happen is we have a bill called 363. It's over in the House of Representatives now. It's to take 63,000 people off of general assistance. I've reviewed the plan. Now, I am responsible for defeating 2044. 2044 was the welfare bill last year. I got on the governor and I stayed on him all the way for the duration, from the House all the way over in the Senate. The first time in the history of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives that any one State representative draft over 300 amendments for one piece of legislation. I walked in there with a little wheelbarrow with my amendments. They said, See, because they had to redo those amendments. And I was on the floor for about 4 or 5 hours just introducing my amendment. You know, you get 300 amendments and argue each one for 7 to 10 minutes, but you go a long time. People be sitting up, sleep. When's he gonna shut up? You know. So what happened, I fought that bill. And we did a lot of work on it. All right? So now they come back in this bill. So I looked at the bill. The bill has rendered me defenseless. I mean, I do not have a defense. I mean, there is nothing I can do with that bill, because all the questions and all my strategies that I used last session, they incorporated in the bill. So I read the bill. I said, they jammed me. Wow. So now, then I had to start thinking. I said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get them good. So next week, I'm going to introduce a bill to just discontinue it altogether. Just stop it. Don't even need it. Get rid of GA. Take it right on out. And what we'll get when we do that is over $250 million, okay, that we spend on GA. And what I say is take that $250 million and float some bonds and multiply it into about $800 million and let's generate some real jobs. We'll talk about welfare reform. Let's stop fooling around, all right? Let's stop fooling around and get down to business. Now, what that does for me politically is it puts me in a position where the governor and them now have to answer me. I don't have to answer them. Because all the news people are going to run and say, what do you think about streets plan? I say, come on, man. You don't respond to my plan. I am not going to run around all the time responding to somebody else's plan. I have my own plans. Let them respond to me. Now, it's going to be unusual. Okay, then it's going to shock people. They're going to say, my God, he fought for it. But if you look at it, it makes sense. I really looked at it. Last year when I was fighting 2044, I did not have one person who was on general assistance come into my office and say, I want you to fight against that piece of legislation because I want general assistance. Not one. 83,000 people receiving it, not one. So what that tells me is there's really no constituency out there that wants it. It really isn't. But if you look at the governor's plan, you'll find out that what we are doing is just taking money and shifting it. That money is not going to generate anything for the taxpayers. It's not going to do anything for the taxpayers. It's not going to help the taxpayers in any way, because what we're going to do is shift it over here, give the AFDC an increase. We're going to take some money from this guy's welfare check and give it to the AFDC. We're going to take a little money from and create a little bit of some training programs. People don't need any more training. They need some jobs. Damn the training. They've been trained. All right? Now, those who can't read, those who can't write, those who can't work in small businesses, we create some public service jobs. Everybody can use his hands and use his muscle. We let people work. And it would be a service to the government. And I believe across the state of Pennsylvania that taxpayers do not want us to play tricks with them and just take the money because it's politically feasible to say we have welfare reform, but that money in turn is not going to decrease your taxes. They're not going to decrease your real estate taxes. It's not going to generate any jobs so that they can put people more money into the economy. All they're doing is creating some more social programs. And I say that if we're going to talk about welfare reform, let's not camouflage it. Let's not just do something because it's politically feasible to do it. Let's get them up with some real welfare reform. Let's just discontinue the GA if we're serious now. If we're serious, and tell the people who are on there, look, you're going to have to suffer for a few months or maybe a year or so, you have to struggle. Maybe you have to go down the shore and find a job. Maybe you have to leave the state to find a job. But I will guarantee you we will generate this money and have some solid jobs, some real jobs within a year or a year and a half. And we can take that money and do that. Now that's real welfare reform. That stuff that we've been talking about up there is nothing. Get the bill and look at it. You don't believe me. Boy, that's going to be fun.